You know, last month I spoke about how this current economic downturn has created in men's lives an identity vacuum. I talked about how we begin to question who we really are and what our lives are all about because of so much of who we are is tied to our work. You know, so many men define themselves by what we do or who we know or what we have. And when we do this and find all of this is threatened, there are significant deadly consequences that come into our lives. And I closed our time by considering how to develop a true, healthy identity that can't be shaken by a crisis in the economy. And this morning I want to keep going down this path and elaborate on this some more. And then, believe it or not, we're going to have a part three to this series, which hopefully will be next month sometime, and I'm going to address the issue, what is the true measure of a man? What is the true measure of a man? Now, last month I read you this quote from Tim Keller, and I want to read it again. He said, "We are the first culture," this is an incredible assertion he makes, "we are the first culture in history where men define themselves by performing and achieving in the workplace. It's the way you become somebody and the way you feel good about your life, performing, achieving. For this reason," Keller says, "that there has never been more psychological, social, and emotional pressure out in the marketplace than there is right now." Now that's a pretty incredible assertion. I'm not even sure where he gets his information, but I believe him. And in thinking through this, I'm sure there's several reasons why we're so unique. But two of them I'd like to just maybe share with you, just make a couple of comments, because you know, the better we understand ourselves, the better we'll be able to conduct our lives. Understanding yourself is a real part of wisdom. But I think one of the first reasons is that if you go back in time, you go back 100, 150 years ago, you know, we were clearly a production economy. In other words, most Americans were involved in producing something. I mean, not that you didn't have doctors and lawyers, but most of the economy was involved in producing something. We led the world in production. But what's happened is today, we are a consumer-driven economy. Our economy is driven, or I guess you could say, we are driven by people that consume. You see, it's only been in the last few decades that a major leading economic indicator is the Consumer Confidence Index, which, by the way, has been down significantly the last 5 months. In fact, I've heard many analysts say the key to our economic recovery is that we need to get the consumer buying again. I find it interesting, you know, we're no longer citizens, we are now consumers. But more significantly, we're not a nation of just consumers. We are, this was a word coined at the turn of the last century, we are conspicuous consumers. You know, we don't buy things for their functionality. We buy things to make a statement to the people that are observing our lives, to the people in the community. You know, how we appear in the eyes of others is the driving force behind most consumption of our major purchases in life. In fact, this is very interesting. I read this. This is a quote from a major advertiser who said, our goal is to tap into people's insecurity, into their fear that they do not measure up. That's how we sell them. We don't appeal to their common sense. We appeal to the fear in their lives that they feel insecure, that they don't measure up. Now, a second and probably more significant reason I think that this has happened where we're the first culture in history to find ourselves by achieving and performing in the workplace, is what Daniel Boorstin calls, we have gone through what's called the graphic revolution. It started with photography and evolved to the print media, the television, all the way now to Facebook and YouTube. In fact, you know, as I was preparing this, it made me wonder, you know, I wonder how our lives would be different if our faces and all of our honors and all of our achievements could not show up in the newspaper, could not show up in a business magazine, could not show up on the television. How would our lives would be different? How would they be different? You know, we would clearly be less enthralled with the scores of people now we consider prominent or famous. But what has happened is that the graphic revolution has transformed us so that our public image, our image in the eyes of others, the appearance of success is more important than our private character. And it's certainly more important than a life of humility. David Wells made a very profound statement when he said, "Men today would rather be envied for their material success than respected for their character." Now, I don't know about you, but that's a sobering thought. Now, what I want to do this morning is go forward and share with you some additional thoughts on how this current economic environment impacts our lives as men. This is fascinating stuff, guys. And where I want to start, I want to read some words from Warren Buffett's annual letter to the shareholders at Berkshire Hathaway. This was back in late February. And I'll read you one paragraph. Listen to what he says. "By the fourth quarter of last year, the credit crisis, coupled with tumbling home and stock prices, has produced a paralyzing fear that engulfed the country," Buffett said. "A free fall in business activity ensued, accelerating at a pace that I have never before witnessed. The U.S. and much of the world became trapped in a vicious negative feedback cycle. Fear led to business contraction, and that in turn led to even greater fear." I don't know if you noticed, but in that one paragraph, Buffett uses the word fear three times. And most significantly, he uses that word paralyzing fear that's engulfed our country. There's a real prominent guy in this town who has done very well for himself. And from all I can tell, has never experienced any kind of setback. And he recently made this comment: "For the first time in my life, I'm afraid. I'm afraid." And so when men ask me, what do I see going on out there? That's what I see: fear. Being afraid. And it is paralyzing for some people. Now, I doubt you've thought about this very much, but fear is a very interesting emotion. It's created by one thing: uncertainty over the future. And it operates in the realm of our imagination. You know, it's amazing how we play things out in our minds. And most people don't know what to do with it. Most people don't know what to do with their fears. And what happens? It ends up running wild in their imaginations. Particularly when they wake up at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning and their minds start whirling. That's when fear runs rampant. And it cripples our lives in a multitude of ways. I hadn't planned on telling you this, but you know, that's why Jesus, the number one imperative in the Scriptures, not only the New, just Jesus, but the Old and New Testament, the number one imperative from God to His people is to fear not. Be anxious for nothing. Do not worry. And the reason I think that's the case is because what it does to our lives. Fear cripples a man's life. I don't know how many of you saw in the Sunday paper, Southern historian Wayne Flint, who studied the Great Depression. He studied other economic downturns, and he's made this observation about them. He said, in times like this, the real damage may not be economic, but in its human toll, which can last for generations. He says the stress is just incredible. What is the human toll he speaks of? Well, he talks about divorce. He talks about excessive drinking. He talks about anger, about sleeplessness, depression, and even suicide. Now, what I'd like to do is just take a minute and ask you to consider, what is it that we actually fear? What is it we actually fear? You know, the prominent psychologist Larry Crabb says that you and I have two basic psychological needs in our lives. The first is the need for security, and the second is the need for significance. And what's happened is that this current economic recession, particularly the severity of it, has converged in such a way that the ability to meet these psychological needs has been threatened, and it results in great fear, as Buffett says, paralyzing fear. And then Crabb goes on to say, as well as Ron Blue in his most recent book that he's written, and this is pretty interesting, the two psychological needs are security and significance. He says women particularly feel most threatened about their security. In times like this, they worry about the mortgage getting paid, whether you can put food on the table, whether you can put nice clothes on your children. But they both say that for men, our fears go much deeper. Because what happened is our significance is threatened. Now you may say, what do you mean by significance? It's the belief that your life makes a difference that will last over time. I can assure you there's not a man in this room who wants to get to the end of his life and believe that their life was not important in some way. It's what the famous philosopher Soren Kierkegaard, he said this, every person must find some way to justify their existence, to stave off the universal fear that their lives are not worth anything. You know, last month I quoted from Arthur Miller's famous play, Death of a Salesman. This morning I want to quote from another play. Incredible play. Won a Pulitzer Prize in 1955. A Tennessee Williams play, Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. I never saw the play. I watched the movie with Paul Newman and Elizabeth Taylor. It's an interesting setting. And before I read this to you, you know, Williams was known for having incredible insight into the human heart. And the plot is of a wealthy family on this huge plantation over in Mississippi. And the patriarch of the family is there's a guy, they call him Big Daddy. Burl Ives plays the role of Big Daddy in the movie. And he's got two sons, and one of the sons is played by Paul Newman. His name is Brick. And Brick is married to a woman whose nickname is Cat. They have a tumultuous marriage. Brick was a famous high school athlete in the community. He still hangs on to that. He drinks too much. They have a terrible marriage. And at the end of the play, it's discovered that Big Daddy is dying. And he finds out he's dying of cancer. And he and Brick have this very interesting exchange. Listen to this. Big Daddy says, I am worth, and this is written in 55, I am worth $10 million in cash and blue chip stocks. But there is only one thing you can't buy on any market on earth, And that's your life when you know it is finished. The human animal is a beast that must eventually die. And if he has money, he buys and he buys and he buys. And he hopes one of the things he buys is life everlasting. Now, he's not talking about everlasting life in a spiritual sense. He's talking about significance. And then Brick in their exchange later says, well, why is it you want grandchildren so bad? He didn't have any kids. And Big Daddy had no grandchildren. Listen to what he says. He says, I want a part of me to keep on living. I won't have my life end at the grave. You see, what he had realized is that wealth could not purchase what he really wanted in life. In this last election, many of you probably saw on TV a good bit, Doris Kearns Goodwin. She is probably the most preeminent presidential historian alive today. And you'd see her face on the TV a lot. She's a very sharp, very bright woman. She shares about, this is incredible, an interview she had with Lyndon Johnson a month before he died. She said, he spoke to me with immense sadness in his voice. He said he was watching the American people absorbed in a new president, forgetting him, forgetting even the great civil rights laws he had passed. He was beginning to think his quest for immortality had been in vain, that perhaps he would have been better off focusing his time and attention on his wife and his children. So then he could have had a sort of immortality through his children and their children in turn. He could have depended on them in a way he couldn't depend on the American people. But it was too late. And 4 weeks later, he was dead. Despite all of his money and all of his power, he was completely alone when he died. His ultimate terror realized. Now, it's hard to believe a man could achieve the position of one of the most powerful people in the world and not feel like his life had much enduring value. Now, I'm going to talk about this at length in our next meeting. But let me tell you where I'm trying to get to, and that is this. And again, this comes from Ron Blue's recent book on the economic meltdown. He says, our search for significance, our psychological need for significance, creates in us an incredible fear of failure. That we carry around in us an incredible fear that we're going to fail somehow out in the workplace. You know, Tim Keller says that after all his years of pastoring, he says this is the fear that's, in his opinion, one of the basic motivational drives in our lives. He says the thought of failure to most men is such a nightmare, he says it's like a psychological death. And I believe most men are haunted by the prospect of failing, particularly to fail in front of the people in our community. And as we think about failing, it's so easy, again, to allow our imaginations to run wild, to find our focus consistently, to find our thoughts consistently focused on all types of possibilities that appear out there that could happen in my life. And this fear cascades. It impacts so many other areas of our lives. I'm not going to ask for a show of hands, but I wonder how many of you in the last year have felt depressed. I'm talking more about unipolar depression. Maybe some of you experienced for the first time. You see, what I see with so many men who come see me, they have such a gloomy view of the future. And they fear this possibility of failure, or they have the perception that I am a failure. And I look at them like, what are you talking about? It impacts our relationships. I don't think we realize how it impacts our relationships with other men. Because what we really fear is how our failure might appear in the eyes of other people. And this is why we're always trying to maintain this appearance that my life is together and that I'm flourishing. I'm doing great. When most of us, when it gets right down to us, we'll never share our fears, our pain, our struggles, particularly with any other men. Because who wants to appear to be weak? Who wants to appear like a failure? But let me ask you this, guys. If all I can offer you as a man, as a friend, if all I can offer you is a superficial image of my true self, how could I or why should I ever expect to have anything but superficial, shallow relationships in my life? And that's the reason. But you know what? One final thought. Fear of failure causes us to play it safe in life. In other words, so many of us refuse to take certain risks that we probably should, but we're afraid to fail. We're afraid to fail in the eyes of anybody. We just don't want to look bad. And so we never allow ourselves to get in a position where we might look like a failure in anything. This is why Larry Crabb says that men try to arrange their lives so that everything is predictable and under their control. They pursue endeavors where they feel competent and can hide their inadequacies. I don't know how many of you remember, I've shared this before, but it was a study that was done years ago by a group of sociologists. They went out and did a study, and to be a part of this study, there was one requirement. You had to be 95 years old or over. And they asked this one question. If you could go back and live your life over again, what would you do different? They took all their research and they put it together, and they came up with three answers that kind of emerged more than anything else. The first is, I wish I had reflected more about what's important. I wouldn't have gone through life so fast, so frenetically. Number two, listen to this. This is interesting. I'd have invested my life in more endeavors that will live on after I'm gone. Significance. Third, I'd have taken more risks in life. You realize what these old people were telling us? I played it too safe in life. I was afraid to fail. They're telling us, I wish I knew back then what I know now. I love these words from President Theodore Roosevelt. He said, far better it is to dare mighty things, to win glorious triumphs, even though checkered by failure, than to rank with those poor spirits who neither enjoy much nor suffer much, because they live in the gray twilight that knows not victory nor defeat. You know, it's interesting. The Center for Executive Leadership is moving into its 9th year. It's kind of hard to believe. But from all of my dealings, from all of my teaching, I would say that the issue that I raised last month and what I'm talking about this morning is the number one issue that we have to deal with as men. It's the number one struggle we have. And I talk about it frequently, I teach about it frequently, and as I'm sitting here this morning, I think of Jesus' words in John chapter 5. He encounters a crippled man. He can't walk in Bethesda. And he asks him a very unusual question. This is the question he asks. Do you want to get well? Cripple guy. Do you want to get well? You know, we may not be physically afflicted like this man was, but we're afflicted. We're afflicted in our innermost being, in our hearts and in our souls. And I really believe Jesus is asking all of us, do you want to get well? Do you want to deal with the issue of fear that paralyzes your life? Or do you want to be like the guy who told me, I believe what you've told me is true, but I'm just going to stay on the same path that I'm on. I'm not going to change. You know, in the balance of our time, and then the next time we meet, I want to point you to a different perspective, a different paradigm. A different paradigm from the one that most of us probably operate under or out of. In fact, what I want to ask you to do is consider this economic storm from a biblical perspective and not just a personal human perspective that is so impacted by the media. You know, it's interesting. This is something that I like to do from time to time. I like to do what's called a word study. I'll take a provocative word that's used often in the Bible, and I'll look up every verse on that word, and then I'll do a presentation, a study on it. And I did one several years ago on the word that comes up often in the Bible, and that word is beware. Beware. It's a warning. It's the word most men probably use when their daughter is geared to go out with some guy they don't like on their first date. Beware, watch out. And Jesus uses that word often. And you know what? The number one issue he warns us of? Interesting. Believing what is false. False teaching, false prophets. Believing what is false. Something that has been so helpful to me in counseling people. It's kind of foundational in my approach to trying to talk and help people. Comes from Blaise Pascal, and I believe he got this from Christ. When he says, the primary reason people struggle so much in life is because they have false ideas about reality. They believe what is false. He says you have to, it is critical to uproot these false ideas and replace them with wisdom and truth. And I wonder this morning how many of us have false ideas about this life that we're living. Have false ideas about what does it really mean to be a successful man in this life. As I talked about last month, false ideas about true masculinity. And then false ideas about what is the true measure of a man. And I wonder how many of us have false ideas and thoughts about this current economic downturn that we're in. And the way you see it and the way you view it in your life. Let me read to you two verses from the Old Testament. These are words from the book of Isaiah. Listen to this. For my thoughts are not your thoughts, nor are your ways my ways, declares the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. And then in Psalm 50, verse 21, he says, you thought I was just like you, but I'm not. That's incredible. God is saying, you know, we think He is just like we are. And therefore, He should do things a certain way because this is the way I would do it. But He's saying, I'm not like you. I don't think like you think. I don't see life the way you see it. And I don't see this economic adversity that we're experiencing right now the way you see it. And I think this is particularly true when you consider God's perspective on time. His perspective on time is so different from ours. I think most of us are hoping just to get through 2009, that maybe by the end of the year things will get better and we'll recover. and we wonder about retirement, which looms in the next 5, 10, 20, 25 years. That's what our focus is on. Where in 2 Peter 3:8, we're told 1,000 years is like one day in God's sight. So what am I saying here? What I'm saying is we get so focused on the now, not to say that it's not important, I'm not saying that, but we get so focused on the now, on the next few years of our lives, where God, as He looks at our lives, He's got an eternal perspective. He's interested in our eternal well-being, not just what happens to us this year. So clearly, His ways are not our ways. His thoughts are not our thoughts. And we need to know that and understand that. Now, I want to take just a minute and lay out for you a truth that I believe is so crucial for us to grasp as it relates to fear. And this, I want to start by reading you, this is a true story. It happened in a Nazi concentration camp in Hungary. And the Jews in this concentration camp worked in one of the large factories that supplied the Nazis. It says, one day an Allied aircraft blasted the area and destroyed the hated factory. The next morning, several hundred inmates were herded to one end of the charred remains. Expecting orders to begin rebuilding, they were startled when the Nazi officer commanded them to shovel sand into carts and drag it to the other end of the plant. The next day, the process was repeated in reverse. They were ordered to move a huge pile of sand back to the other end of the compound. A mistake must have been made, they thought. Stupid swine. Day after day, though, they haul the same pile of sand from one end of the camp to the other. Finally, one old man began crying uncontrollably. A guard had to haul him away. Another screamed until he was beaten into silence. Then a young man who had survived 3 years in the camp darted away from the group. The guard shouted for him to stop as he ran toward the electrified fence. The other prisoners cried out, but it was too late. There was a blinding flash and a terrible sizzling noise as smoke puffed from his smoldering flesh. In the days that followed, dozens of prisoners went mad and ran from their work, only to be shot by the guards or electrocuted by the fence. The commandant smugly remarked that there soon would be no more need to use the crematorium. Now, I got this story from one of Charles Colson's books, but the point he tries to make is this, guys, that if our struggles and our pain and what we see going on in our lives, if it just seems purposeless, he says, over time, we will dysfunction as human beings. We'll snap. But it struck me, what if you take this same scenario, what if these men were told, all right, we're going to build an orphanage for Hungarian children whose parents have died in the war. Even though it may have been back-breaking work, do you think that would have made a difference? You see, this is what's so important to grasp, guys. The meaning behind what you are experiencing in your life is everything. In other words, if you see meaning in it, if you see meaning in what you're going through, if you see meaning in the storm that's in your life, it'll transform that storm. Paul Brand shares another example of this just to get understand the point. And I don't mean to be crass, but this is what he says, and he's a very godly man. He says, take a woman who is in love with her husband, has a romantic evening, and has sexual relations with him. And then he says, take that same woman, and the next day she is forcibly raped by a stranger. Brand says, physiologically, it's the same act involving the same nerve ending. He says, but for one experience, it's of great beauty and meaning. He says, the other is the worst nightmare a woman could ever imagine. And the point he makes is, the meaning behind what you're experiencing is everything. Jesus drives this point home right before his disciples are going to be taken into custody. or before he's to be taken into custody. And in John chapter 16, verse 21, he says, whenever a woman is in labor, she has pain because her hour has come. But when she gives birth to the child, she no longer remembers the anguish because of the joy that a child has been born in the world. You know, he said this before we had epidurals. But I want to tell you something. When my wife had our first child, he came so fast and we got to the hospital that the epidural didn't take. So she delivered my oldest naturally. And I'm there watching, and I want to tell you something. It's the most painful thing I can ever imagine having to go through. And yet, soon after my son was born, she was ready to have another one. Now the point, I think, here is that a mother's pain produces something with meaning, a new life. And for that reason, she can even contemplate repeating the experience without fear and without anxiety. You see, the point I'm making, guys, is so crucial to grasp, and it is foundational if you are going to effectively deal with fear in your life. Because in the midst of the storms of life, we will either allow what we're experiencing to interpret our view of God and our view of life, or we will allow our view of God to interpret what we're experiencing. And if we will look at our fears through the lens of God's truth, they will truly be transformed. And one thing God makes clear, there is purpose in pain and suffering. I remember having a young man, he was young at the time, a number of years ago, a cancer survivor, tell me, through my battle with cancer, I have come to understand that suffering is good for us. There is purpose in it. And then he says this, it makes you focus on what's really important in life. As I share this, it won't be surprising to some of you that this reminds me of the words of Alexander Solzhenitsyn. Solzhenitsyn died last year. Another Pulitzer Prize winning author. He gave that controversial commencement address at Harvard in 1978 called World Split Apart. He wrote some disparaging words about Joseph Stalin and was thrown into prison for 8 years. For 8 years. He went into prison as an atheist. He came out of prison as a Christian. And the first words that came out of his mouth when he walked out of that prison 8 years later was, I bless you, prison. I bless you for being in my life. For there, lying on that rotting prison straw, I learned that the object of life was not prosperity as I had grown up believing, but it is the maturing of the soul. Have you ever given much thought to that issue he just raised? What is the object of life? The object of life. You know, if you believe that the object of life is comfort and pleasure and prosperity, then you will see this current economic crisis as nothing more than a calamity in our lives, and we will be fearful, and we will be angry, and we will get bitter. And that's what you see going on out in the landscape. But if the object of life is the maturing of the soul, the transformation of your character, and knowing God personally, then you'll see hardship just as Solzhenitsyn. It could be a real blessing in your life. How could he or anyone say that 8 years of prison, away from family, away from friends, away from comfort, could be a blessing? You know what he's saying? It's the only way for him to find the spiritual truth of life that he had been blind to. Have you ever thought about this? What in life, what important issues in life might I be blind to? You know, as I was preparing this, I was reminded of these words in Jeremiah 22 where God says this. Maybe this applies to... He says, I spoke to you in the midst of your prosperity, but you wouldn't listen. In other words, I'm trying to speak to you into your life in the midst of your prosperity, but you wouldn't listen. In the New Testament, Paul says, you know, there's a point in my life, God brought me to the point of almost dying, but he delivered me. But I almost died. And he says, what I've realized is he was trying to teach me not to trust in myself, but in God who raises the dead. Guys, some of life's most sacred truths are learned only as we walk through the storms of life. Now, I think it's quite apparent that what we are currently experiencing in the economy is man's doing. There's no doubt about it. We are reaping from being an over-leveraged economy. But you know what happens? This is the wonderful thing, that when we screw up, God finds a way to use it for good. And the question I would leave you with this morning is, how is he trying to use this in our lives? How is he trying to use this in my life? What's he trying to teach me? Maybe, just maybe for some of us, he's trying to make a spiritual breakthrough in our lives. This is what he was trying to do with the wealthy Christians in Laodicea. And I leave you with these thoughts. There was a church in Laodicea, very wealthy. And I want you to listen to the words from the book of Revelation, the third chapter, the 17th and 18th. This is what he said. He could be talking to us. Because you say I am rich and have become wealthy, I have need of nothing else in this life. But what you do not realize is that spiritually you are wretched and miserable and poor and blind and naked. So I advise you to buy from me true gold that is refined by fire, so that you might become rich, and white garments that you might clothe yourself, and eye salve to anoint your eyes that you might see. You know what God is saying to these folks? He's probably saying it to us as well. Come to me, and I'll give you true wealth. Come to me, and I'll forgive you of your sins. Come to me, and I will give you wisdom and understanding. Come to me, and I will replace your fear, that fear that paralyzes your life. I will replace it with my peace, a peace that he says surpasses all understanding. Come to me, and I will love, and I will care for you with an everlasting love. But you have to come to me. I am the source. I am, as the scripture says, I am the fountain of life. I close with a final verse from the Old Testament. 1 Samuel chapter 2. There is no one holy like the Lord. Indeed, there is no one beside you. Nor is there any rock like our God. Guys, we have experienced so much fear these past 15 months because our security and because our significance has been built upon those things that can be taken away from us. So as you think about your life, as you think about your future, it's crucial to know this one truth and to build your life on this one truth. There is no other rock. There is no other rock like our God. Let me pray. Lord, I realize that so many of us, in so many ways, easily believe what is false. We listen to the world around us and we allow the world around us to define manhood, success, and what life is all about. And when it begins to slip away, we question who we are and what our lives are all about. I pray, Lord, that you would draw us to yourself, that you would give us that wisdom. Lord, that you'd help us to realize that truth is found in Christ, that solid rock. There is no other rock but you. I thank you for these men, for their lives. We thank you for just all the relationships that exist in this room. And we're grateful, Lord, that there is purpose in suffering. And that maybe, just maybe, you're trying to break through into our lives. And we thank you for that. In Christ's name, amen.